When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Job numbers, pretty good job numbers. 187,000 jobs created in the month of August. That is up from the 170 that was expected. Unemployment rose 3.8%. You go, oh, sky falling. No. 750,000 people back into the workforce. People coming out looking for jobs. Good thing. Labor participation back up to where it was pre-pandemic levels. We're moving in the right direction, folks. Things are going well. Still a lot of work to do. Lots of work to do. But heading in the right direction. And this, much to the chagrin of the folks on the extreme right, who have been, pining for recession, have been pining for chaos, for more pain and suffering for working people. And I got to tell you, the reality of this administration has been doing just about everything I could have asked them to do on the employment front. They're literally killing it. This is one of those moments where you go, give them credit where credit is due. Today, for instance, another thing that I think is important. They've come forth and said that we need to have better regulation in our nursing care facilities. They are going to set up the first nationwide minimum standards situation for nursing homes across the country. Because I was reading this editorial at the USA Today. They said, over the first 90 days of this year, only 141 of the nation's nearly 15,000 skilled nursing facilities met the minimum requirement for registered nurses and certified aid standards. Just 141 out of 15,000. Now, what we've allowed to happen to our nursing home system is, in my view, mostly criminal. We've privatized most of it. Most of the county homes that we used to have, that we used to run, we've hocked off for pennies. And, you get these people who come in and how can I make money off of it? And how they make money off of it, they cut standards. They cut staff. They cut corners. They cut care. They smash as many people as they can into different facilities. I got to tell you, it's time that we start putting some of these minimum standards in place. And I'm glad that the administration has done it. Now, as I've been saying, look, I think the administration's been killing it. The things that they've been coming out with, just fantastic on the labor front. You know, we've talked about, you know, speeding up union elections. We've talked about the NLRB and the stuff that they've done. We talked about the overtime threshold that they've asked to move up. Lots of things moving and pointing and driving us in a good strong direction. And I think I've been saying that. And giving this administration as much credit as they've earned. I'm not a hero worship person. And I think Democrats had better stop with the hero worship. Biden's doing his job, and he's doing a darn good job of it. And you give him credit when they do a good job. But you also got to hold them accountable when they don't. And thus far, the Biden administration is doing a good job, worthy of adulation, worthy of respect, worthy of praise. And they get that. And the reason I bring this up is yesterday I started a segment off with a headline about Biden not taking evidently Biden's now taking smaller steps to get into Air Force One. And this has been a theme of the media for a very long time. And I said, look, why not just write the stories and Joe Biden's old? And immediately my email is full of people who are, you're attacking him. No. I am not attacking Joe Biden. I'm simply saying what is true. Joe's old. Joe struggles with speaking. That doesn't mean his policies are bad. It doesn't mean I'm not going to vote for him. I'm voting for the policies. But you know, I got all this stuff. You know, you're part of the circular firing squad. You're stabbing him in the back, ankle biters. You name it. I got every attack that you could come up with. And I'm a couple of the people. I said, did you hear what I said? Were you listening? It was an indictment of our media structure for really pushing this narrative that you know, Biden can't do the job. I think he can. And I think he's doing a darn good job of it, surrounding himself with, oddly enough, the very best people who are doing a very good job, especially at the NLRB and the Department of Labor. Now, that said, I find it interesting that we can't talk about the fact that, you know, he's got some issues come election time. The fact that we can't talk about that without everyone getting all bunched up tells me we got problems. And as I've said, I think he's doing a fantastic job. I'll put his policies against what the Republicans have come out with. I'll put up the job creation. I'll put up the labor standards. I'll put up, you know, especially this most recent stuff. I'll put all this up: the infrastructure bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, the investments in climate stuff. I'll put all that up on the table against anything the Republicans have, because they've got nothing. And the reason I say they've got nothing is in Michigan. And this, again, this is another thing: Democrats doing the work that they should be doing, not hero worship, just doing their jobs, doing what we've sent them into office to do and demanding that they do. Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, has a proposal to pay folks paid leave, paid family leave. So if you have, you know, a birth of a child, you have a sickness, you need to take care of a loved one who's sick, you get a little paid time off to help deal with life's problems. Whatever it is, you're sick, a kid's sick, you, whatever. Republicans in Michigan are messaging around the idea that this proposal is just it's just summer break for adults. And you go, no, anybody who's had to take care of a loved one, and I've had to take care of sick family members, anyone who's been sick themselves, been there myself, sick kids, you know, whatever. You need that time. That is a family value. That is a working class issue. Something most certainly working people should be behind. But the Republicans see it as, oh, it's just summer break for adults. It tells you what they think of working people. It tells you what they think of us. I mean, they're honest. Give them credit. They're at least honest. Fact of the matter is, they're doing everything they can do to interject themselves into our lives while telling us that they want freedom. And I look at Texas, for instance. There are a number of towns in Texas who are on the abortion front. They're going to start this. It's mind-blowing, but it was predictable. And we had talked about this right when Roe was overturned. All of the ways that Republicans were going to put themselves in the middle of your life and inconvenience you just because you might be getting an abortion. And there have been towns in Texas that have passed ordinances that are going to stop you on the highway. You could be going on a highway somewhere to an airport or a train station. So it's even beyond papers, please. It's a pregnancy test, please. You might not be able to leave the state until you take a pregnancy test. So when I look at the reality of where we are, the policies that are being put forth, because again, understand, I am not a hero worship person. I didn't have all that much faith in Robert Mueller because that didn't happen. Merrick Garland is not a savior. Obama wasn't a savior. I liked Obama. I liked his policies on a certain front. He left a lot on the table. There was a lot that could have been done, should have been done, I wish would have been done. But I never bought to the hero worship, and I'm not going to do that for Joe Biden. This is the kind of stuff that drives me crazy. We can criticize our elected leaders when they're wrong. We give them praise when they do what they're supposed to. This isn't that hard to figure out. So for all the people who sent me emails, I appreciate the thoughts. I do. I get your defensive. But this is one of those things that gets us attacked quite often. Be honest about the situation. Biden's not a great public speaker. But you know what he is? He's a great policy guy. The stuff that he's putting forth, the stuff they're dropping out, killing it. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Gotta take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So today, the administration announced $15.5 billion in investment that's going to help transition our auto manufacturing into electric vehicle factories, moving those jobs from one to the other. This is important stuff, but it's good policy. That, to me, is what... That's what we should be doing, without question. Let's quick go to the phones. Got Kurt in Akron on line one. Kurt, how are you?
Hey, good evening and happy Labor Day to you, Rick. You deserve it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. And, hey, another one that was a couple weeks ago that a lot of people probably don't know is Mingo County, West Virginia. The Biden administration made it possible for alternative energy source factories to be made to replace the coal mines that have been devastated down there for decades.
Yeah. No, I mean, the amount of investment that's going into areas that hate him is truly impressive. And for him, it's not about, did you vote for me? Or it's about doing what's in the best interest of the country. And I give him credit
right,
for that.
It's about what's doing right for the people who need it the most is what it comes down to. But, you know, I was listening to my archives today, and I was listening to FDR, and he said something, and it can kind of apply to Biden, President Biden, I think. And that is, President Roosevelt said that between 1913 and 1921, he was close enough to world affairs that he learned Between 1913 and 1921, he was close enough to world affairs to learn what to do, but more importantly, he learned what not to do. And what I'm getting at is Joe Biden, what you're talking about with his policy record and everything, take the Senate stuff aside, but just the fact that between 2009 and 2017, he was close enough to world affairs that he learned what to do, but again, more importantly, what not to do when it comes to how he governed.
Yeah.
So we're actually in a good position in the sense that he was a vice president for 8 years, and he was the last person to always leave the room after a policy meeting with Barack Obama. So what I'm getting at is, he had a lot of not really on the job training, but he had a lot of, what's the word I'm looking for?
Exposure. He's seen a lot of stuff.
He's seen a lot of stuff to the point where he stutters and he comes off as, I don't want to say an idiot to some people, but the fact that he stutters and he can't get it out, like you said, he's not the greatest speaker in the world. He's not a stupid man. That's what people don't get. I've heard people call him Geriatric Joe and some derogatory statements beyond that. But my question to the age thing, too, is if Joe Biden's going to be 81 and you were railing, not you, but people who voted against him were railing against him for being 78, why are you not making a big deal about Donald Trump being 78?
Shh. You're not allowed to say that.
Oh, I'm not?
No. Shh. You're pointing out the hypocrisy,
right?
And you can't do that.
Oh, no. Oh, also, another thing I heard today. Remember when President Reagan said, well, it's morning in America again, back in 1984?
Yeah, yeah.
You remember what the statistics were for that morning in America?
Well, we had high unemployment and high inflation, as I remember it, because I lived through it.
We had 4% inflation and 7% unemployment. Joe Biden should be winning 49 out of 50 states, maybe losing Wyoming, which is the most conservative state in the country next year, given the record of what he's got versus what Ronald Reagan had 40 years ago.
Yep.
Just saying, people, history, just, you know, but, you know, Ron DeSantis and all those guys don't want you to know about that.
There you go. Good stuff, Kurt. Appreciate it, man.
Thank you.
No, I mean, Kurt's spot on. I mean, the reality is if you use the same metrics, as I said, Biden's killing it. The difference is, and I talked about this yesterday a bit, Biden's had a ton of accomplishments. Just not doing a great job, you know, getting it out there, letting people know, hey, look what I've done. And this is where I said from the beginning, there should be 20-foot statues all over the place of that stupid thing that they were putting on gas pumps. You know, Biden did that. Going, yeah, look, Biden did that. Job numbers, unemployment's good. The economy's moving in the right direction. We got all of these policy things that are happening, all this infrastructure, all this manufacturing. Yeah, did that. Take credit for it. Blow your own horn. Let's go to line two. We got Alice on line two. Alice, how are you today?
Insane as usual.
What's on your mind?
I knew what you meant last night. I did catch the beginning of the show, and then I was on a cat rescue mission, which fell through, but I knew what you meant.
All right, that's all I did. Because I got to tell you, I got so much response that I'm like, did I explain myself wrong? What was I off? And I actually went back and listened to it again, and I'm going, no, I said what I wanted to say. The media's beating up on poor Joe. Just write the story. Say he's old. Get past it, and let's talk about the work that he's actually doing.
Yeah, apparently some people weren't paying close attention to what you said. They just caught at the end. And the other thing I wanted to comment on was I did read that story in the Washington Post about the town passing the ordinances, and I was like, what the hell are they doing? Is this not against, like, federal law? About, isn't there something in there about moving freely from state to state, and moving on the highways easily and whatnot? Am I just dreaming this?
Well, state to state you can go through, but town to town, that's a whole other story. They're trying to get you. They're trying to stop you on every road. They're going to shut down any underground railroad before you even get on the train.
Oh, I know. And then they quoted the one council member saying she was a Jesus lover. I thought, you know what? I am so tired of you people and your Jesus lovers and all this. And I'm a good God-fearing Christian, and they're the worst people on the planet. It's just ridiculous. And happy Labor Day.
Thanks, Alice. No, look, the reality is I want her to be a Jesus lover. I do. I actually do, because he believed in feeding people and clothing people and all of those things that they don't want to do. If you're such a hyper-Christian, hyper-religious, and not even Christian, if you're hyper-religious, you know, shouldn't that be where you're going? Instead of forcing people to have children that they can't afford, maybe figure out how to help them? Instead of this kind of stuff, it's very conservative. Bring on the Christian Sharia law. I had someone yell at me for that as well. You know, the Christians don't want Sharia law. You go, yeah, have you noticed? They want to plaster their rules all over the place that they don't remember. I mean, that's the amazing part. And I always think about the one pastor I had on the show. It's got to be, it was back during the Obama years. James David Manning was his name. He came on the show because he was calling, you know, Barack Obama homosexual and all kinds of stuff. Just, you know, very, very Christian, you know. And I asked him about those 10 rules, especially the one about bearing false witness, since, you know, he was making some pretty, you know, fantastical claims that I don't know how he could prove other than, you know, he believed. And I love that about my believer friends. But he was hell-bent on, we got to plaster those rules all over the place and force people into obeying them. And when I asked him, can you tell me what those rules are? He didn't know. He told me he would read it to me out of the book. And I said, no, I want them in your own words. You know, not in any particular order. Start in the middle, work yourself at the top, you know. And he wouldn't. He absolutely wouldn't. And this is my problem with that crowd. They want to impose their things on everyone else, but not quite so much for themselves. And that's my problem in all of this. I know the wealthy are going to get whatever they want. You know, whatever health care, whatever reproductive care, whatever they want, they get. It's the poor and the working class that get screwed. We've seen this over and over again. This is not new. There's nothing new here. You look at history, this is what it is. And you know, I go back to what Kurt said a second ago. You know, they're beating up on Biden, you know, for being Sleepy Joe and, you know, Geriatric Joe. But somehow, you know, he's this super mastermind who's doing all of this stuff, you know, secretly against Trump. He's masterminding all of the indictments. He's at masterminding, you know, just this genius. But he's doing it while he's sleeping, which is twisted. I don't know how you can juggle. I don't know how you keep both those thoughts at the same time and then justify it. I just don't. But it is what it is. Another story, another quick bit before we take a break here. Evidently U.S. oil production has risen to almost 13 million barrels a day. It's the highest since February of 2020. What's important about that is that's before the pandemic. Now, as I've said for a long time, you've got people go, Joe Biden, you killed the Keystone Pipeline. Nope, Joe Biden didn't do anything to the Keystone Pipeline. Keystone Pipeline is working just fine, thank you very much. And it's doing everything it was built to do, and it's doing it the way it's supposed to. It's the XL pipeline, the Keystone XL that was killed. That was never going to help us. It was never going to come here. It was never going to do anything for our needs. But this story that we're now back to pre-pandemic output is interesting in that finally the oil companies are ramping up production. You know, I've said for a very long time, we're getting screwed at the pump, not because of Biden, but because of corporate America, because of the collusion, because of the not wanting to produce more, because, hey, they were happy. If you listen to the earnings call, they were thrilled where the production was and the price of oil was, because they're raking in massive profits. They don't care about you or your family. And then the easy scapegoat was, well, look what Joe Biden did. He killed the Keystone XL pipeline, which was never going to help us, ever. But don't let facts get in the way of reality, because it ruins a good narrative. Don't let that happen. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. More on the education assault. This story blows my mind, but again, not surprising. Stick around. Right back after this.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, as you know, there's a lot of labor activity going on around the country. You know, we've been talking about all of the strikes going on. You know, WabTech, they finally they agreed to a resolution there out in Erie, PA. You've got the strike going on with the Writers Guild and the Screen Actors. All this stuff going on. And on the education front, you're seeing lots of organizing. Our friends over at UE are organizing grant assistance and folks just at an incredible pace. But here in my backyard, the local community college, we've been following it it's been like 2 years they've been trying to organize, and they've been organizing. And finally, last April, they won. And it's time to start bargaining. It's time to start getting down to the nuts and bolts. And well, I don't think it's been going great. And that's why I've asked Kathy Sicker to come talk with us. Kathy's the president of the Harrisburg Area Community College Education Association. Their website, hackea.org. We'll get links out on social media. I can take a look at that. Kathy, thanks for taking time for us.
All right. Thanks for having me.
So you guys have gone through what is a very long organizing process, as I remember. We'd had a bunch of people on over the last couple of years talking about the work that you guys have done. You won your election, and you were moving forward. What's going on?
Right. So we unionized in April of 2022. So we are a new young union at Harrisburg Area Community College. We represent full-time, part-time, adjunct faculty. There's almost 900 faculty in our bargaining unit. And so do you want me to get into the story and why I'm here?
The point where you get to, we'll get to that. I just want to know about the organizing. What took to get here?
Yes. So I was not part of the organizers, but I supported it all along the way. And then the majority of the faculty voted in April of 2022. And so we are an official, legally recognized union in the state of Pennsylvania. And we are the last community college in Pennsylvania to unionize.
Wow. I didn't realize that you were the last. Now, you're recognized. You have the right to represent your members. Legally, yes. You're supposed to be where your members are. So on Wednesday, when two representatives of the union get arrested for being on campus, this is kind of a weird thing, isn't it?
It's just shocking. It's unbelievable.
Why were they arrested? Because I'm trying to read through the stories that have been there. In fact, I know one of the people who was arrested very well. I know she's not a troublemaker. I know she's a really nice person.
Right.
Why did they arrest these? I'm still trying to figure out why they were arrested.
It's the tale of two stories, and we at our local completely disagrees with the decision that PAC management made that day. Starting in July, myself and some other union members who are on the exec committee were starting to organize our membership drive that was starting at the beginning of the academic semester. And so we took about 5 weeks this summer to get organized with information about the local, wanted to get the word out to the faculty about us. you know, since we organized over a year and a half ago, we took the last year, drafted our first contract, we're in negotiations, set up our committees, you know, organized our constitution and bylaws, got our feet, got settled. So, you know, we were going to kick off this academic year with a very large membership drive to get the word out to the faculty about their option to join the union, which is a voluntary option in this country.
Right.
So we had had a successful membership event at York Hack last Tuesday, August 22nd. It's called our week zero. It's the week before the students come back to class. The faculty were on campus on Tuesday. We went through the proper protocol, got permission to put up a membership information table. You know, I had ordered custom tablecloths that say Hack EA with our logo on it. I spent the weekends with my kids putting labels on brochures so we could hand out information to faculty as they came for the event. Over their lunch, they could come and get information. You know, we have reusable grocery bags, water bottles, stress balls, buttons. You know, you can come to the table, you can walk past the table, and you can ignore the table. It's just a table with information. And we are there to talk to you if you want to talk to us. So there were over 100 faculty in York last week, and it was very successful. There was a lot of energy, a lot of enthusiasm. And so we were planning information tables at all the Hack campuses starting this week when the students come back. And I had organized faculty at Lancaster. They were union faculty, and faculty at Harrisburg. And I had done the table request for Lancaster for this Wednesday's table. And I had emailed the proper events coordinator person on the 21st, well over a week ahead of time. I was ignored, emailed again on the 24th, no reply, emailed another follow-up on the 28th, informing them, you know, we are putting our information table at Lancaster. I had already dropped the supplies off to my union faculty member at Lancaster the week before, you know, the tablecloth, all the swag, the merchandise to give out. And he had organized other local faculty, Hack employees, faculty members to stand at the table. And then Hack's attorney spoke to our PSEA Uniserv on, I believe, the day before and said, your tables are not approved. You are an outside entity with a special interest, and you're not allowed on campus. And we were just blown away. Like, we're not an outside entity.
You're the faculty. Okay. How can you be an outside entity?
We're employees. We're the local recognized union at Harrisburg Area Community College. We had already done a successful event, which maybe was intimidating because it was so enthusiastic and energetic, and we were so happy with it. And that's what we are planning to continue to do. So our table request was denied, and we believe that we have every right to be standing at an information table on a college campus where there's a First Amendment right to free speech, and we're protected under Act 195 of Pennsylvania labor law. And when we were in York, our PSCA reps, Adam Weber and Lori Lebo, the two that were arrested in Lancaster, were with us in York as well. And, you know, PSCA is our state organization. So we're the local, PSCA is our state, and then there's the NEA, which is our national. So we are one, basically. They represent us at the state and national level, and PSCA is our advocate. They help us through labor law. They've helped us set up the union. You know, I've never been a union president, so they've been very helpful to me and resourceful to all of us. And so Adam and Lori were at the Lancaster table with our faculty members assisting them, just that they were in York. And the Hack security was ready for us to tell us that we were not welcome to be there and asking us to leave. There's plenty of video out there. You can watch it for yourself on CBS 21 News. And we did not go to Lancaster expecting to be arrested.
Yeah, you went there expecting to talk to your members.
We expected to host an information table. And I had even had literature printed out, because I'm just blown away by this, because I had I had had literature printed out for students in case students walked by, because I thought this is such a great educational experience about democracy and labor unions. You know, the bedstone of our democracy is a labor union and what it does for the employees to have a seat at the table and bargaining a collective. And they can, you know, students can join the PSC if they want. There's scholarships available. There's conferences for them to go to. So I was so excited that, you know, maybe some students would walk by and get some information about labor unions.
Well, they got some information, all right. And this, I mean, this could be one of those moments that this could be a massive organizing opportunity to look at the university as a union buster and hold them and begin holding them accountable. Because look, it shouldn't have to be like this. It should not be this adversarial.
No,
because you guys still have to sit down and hammer out an agreement.
We are negotiating, which has been very slow, and they are stalling. It has been extremely slow. We are negotiating our first contract, which is the most important contract because it's the rock of our future at HAC. And we recognize that. And so anyway, at Lancaster, I don't know if you've watched the video footage.
I did.
HAC's head of security was there from Harrisburg, which is interesting because it was Lancaster campus. And that's what someone told me, that he is from Harrisburg.
No, they clearly wanted to pick a fight. This is clearly a message of them showing you that they're in control.
They made the choice to call the police on the faculty. And you can even hear in the video that the safety officer says that if the faculty don't leave the table, our union faculty, they will be arrested just like Adam Weber and Lori Lebo. So they were given an order. So they walked away and our PSCA reps took the fall for us. They advocated for our faculty and said, we have a right to be here to give out information to faculty. And they said, we're not leaving. And then so HAC instructed the police to arrest them. And I think what's interesting about that is that in HAC's statement, they say that it was a political stunt on our behalf to get arrested. We didn't go there to be arrested.
Yeah.
We went there to host an information table.
Yeah, nobody wants that hassle. You wanted to talk to potential members. You wanted to talk to the student body. You wanted to promote what you're doing. I mean, that's what you're legally allowed to be doing. I mean, that's the part that gets me. And I guess down the road, this will work itself out, but it just shows what employers, what lengths that they will go to deny workers their ability to fight for better wages, hours, and conditions. And, you know, I look at you before we went on air, you said that, you know, your department, once you became union president, seemed to mysteriously go away.
I've been at HAC for 17 years. I was adjunct for 12, and I'm one of the founding members of the gerontology program. So it's the study of aging, and I've been full time for the last 5 years. In October, I was called into a meeting very abruptly and told that we have three programs in gerontology. All three programs are being deactivated. And I was also informed that I was on my fifth year of tenure track, that my tenure was being denied, and I was given a 2-year teach out. And I was absolutely shocked. Of course, I took union reps with me to that meeting because I thought something was suspicious. And thankfully, I'm thankful that I did, because I didn't know what to do at that point. And they walked me through the process. The union fought for me. I did get my tenure given to me by the Board of Trustees in February. So I'm now a tenured professor.
Good for you.
And I am being reassigned to a new discipline because I have 2 master's degrees. I can teach in other disciplines. But the way this went about was just shocking. Shocking. I mean,
is it shocking though, Kathy? I mean, you know, I got to tell you, I've heard these stories, you know, time and time again. The employer, it doesn't matter what the employer is, it doesn't matter if they're making widgets or educating college students. It's the same playbook. It's all about intimidation. It's all about imposing their power and their will and whether you're going to stand up and fight back. And clearly your union is doing that, you know, But for me, the message that comes out of this to the broader public is we need to have much stronger labor laws in this country. And we need politicians who are going to stand up to these employers, whether it is people making widgets or educating college students, because it shouldn't be this difficult to fight to get better wages, hours and conditions.
Well, you know, you would expect an institute of higher learning to respect the ideals of the First Amendment and the freedom of speech in a public space. I mean, I guess maybe I was naive, but that's what shocks me the most. You know, we're here to teach students about our democracy, and we just want a seat at the table. And I've been a school director for 8 years. I've been a school board president. So I've been on the other side of contract negotiations with teachers. But I can tell you that you can have a good relationship with the union. You can bargain a good contract and have excellent conversation and put the things in the contract that are good for both sides. I've seen that happen. And that's our goal at HAC, is we want to bring stability back to HAC. We want to have an equitable contract and a fair contract for our faculty. And we want them to listen to us, and we will listen to them as well. So that's all we're asking. Yeah. And continuing to slow the bargaining and stall, we're going to bargain a contract. So let's just do it.
Yeah. No. So last
Let's
question.
Let's just get to the table and do it.
There you go. Last question I've got for you. How can we help? I mean, clearly, you know, the administration is going to, hopefully bow to some public pressure, because this doesn't look good on them. You know, I've asked a couple of people, and they go, this does not look good on a college setting. What can people do to help?
Well, first of all, I would like HAC to apologize, drop the charges, and ensure that we can have membership tables at the campuses without the threat that our faculty union members will be arrested. And I would like them to come to the table and start bargaining. In our last negotiations meeting was the beginning of August, and our next one is not scheduled till September 22nd. That's not acceptable. We need to be meeting more often than that. So how can people help? You know, I think we all want Harrisburg Area Community College to be the best community college we can possibly have, because it benefits our community, it benefits our employers, it benefits our students, it benefits their families. And we know that community colleges are very important for people to make college affordable. So I just wish people would pay attention to this story. You know, you're welcome to have me back to talk, and I'll give you updates on what's going on. And I hope that this just isn't a 24-hour news story, that this is something that people really pay attention to, because some of the things that are coming out on behalf of HAC aren't true. So if people want to know the truth, you know, they can ask me, they can come to the union. We have nothing to hide. It's easy for me to talk about this because I'm talking about facts and I'm talking about the truth.
Well, I hope you'll come back and keep us up to date on how things are progressing here. Because again, this is, sadly, what happens when workers stand up and demand their rights. But Kathy Sicker, I appreciate you taking some time for us. But by all means, please come back and keep us up to date.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Kathy's the president of the Harrisburg Area Community College Education Association. We'll get links out on social media. I can check out their website. And maybe there's a spot on there you can email, get some information, or maybe call the college president and you know, I don't know, something. I'm not going to say anything mean, but maybe something. It's a quick break. Back with your thoughts. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1893. That was the day that the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers and Iron Shipmakers of America was founded in Chicago. This joined two earlier boilermaker unions into one. They decided to establish their headquarters in Kansas City, Kansas. 2 years later, the Boilermakers affiliated with the American Federation of Labor. The union represents members of 250 lodges in the United States and Canada. At the turn of the 20th century, the Boilermakers had about 8,500 members. But their membership expanded, especially during World War II, as shipbuilding grew for the war. By 1944, there were more than 350,000 Boilermakers. In 1954, they merged with the International Brotherhood of Blacksmiths, Drop Forgers, and Helpers, and expanded their name to include these groups of workers. But what exactly is a Boilermaker? According to the union's website, the term can have many meanings. It might refer to a Purdue University student or alumni whose football team started going by the name of the Boilermakers in 1891. Or Boilermaker might refer to dropping a shot of whiskey into a draft beer and drinking it all at once. But for the labor movement, a Boilermaker is someone that constructs and repairs boilers and the other workers who are part of the union. These might include blacksmiths, forgers, shipbuilders, cement workers, stove workers, metal polishers, and numerous other job descriptions. The Boilermaker's logo reflects these workers. It includes images of a ship, a worker working on a boiler, and a blacksmith's anvil. Below the images are found the words unity, progress, and protection, declaring the mission of the union and its members. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So you gotta love Florida. And, you know, you look at this whole push for vouchers. And, you know, in every state there's a movement to get these wonderful vouchers. You know, because... And this is where, you know, I don't blame parents, because we all want our kids to get the best possible education. We all want them to do, great things. I mean, I was thinking about it yesterday, you know, with my son. I remember, the day he was born, going, the promises every parent makes, that we're going to, everything that you're going to, every opportunity that I didn't have, you're going to get, and, all that stuff. So I don't blame parents too much, but I look at these voucher schemes, and the story coming out of Florida right now is evidently, Florida, made vouchers much, much easier to get. And what they found out is, and what they're okay with is how parents are spending those education dollars, theme park passes, 55-inch, colored TVs, stand-up paddle boards, all of these new ways of spending education dollars. Are you surprised that some people would take the money and fret it away? No. In fact, I believe that a lot of our Republican friends who push these kind of things want that. If we can squander as much education money as possible, we can say, look, it doesn't work. We need to privatize. And the frustrating part in this is it's working. The frustrating part in all of this is in every state, just about, you've got these schemes that have popped up. And for every dollar that comes out of the public schools, and goes into these silver bullet voucher schemes or charter schools or virtual cyber charter or whatever the latest gimmick is, that's money that's not going into your local public school. And that's part of the plan. Part of the plan is to starve. It goes back to the Grover Norquist. I want government so small I can drag it in the bathtub and drown it in the bathtub. But when I saw this story, I'm going, it's not shocking to me. It's not surprising to me that this is what happens. And it's the reason that I'm dead set against the homeschooling movement. Now, as I've said a couple of times, especially here this week, as the story broke at the Washington Post, that you've got this attorney who for decades has been working to promote homeschooling and tax dollars going into that. Because there's a way to, one, kill off public education, but two, and more importantly, enrich their followers. and ultimately themselves. Because sadly, Education Incorporated is all about making money. Your kids don't matter in that. And that's the frustrating part. You know, I know a lot of public school teachers, and it's about the kids. In these private settings, it's about the dollars and cents. And the perfect place to look at this is the university setting. All of these for-profit colleges that have popped up to where it's all about keeping you in school. You know, when I went to college, you had to fight to stay in. You had to attain a grade to be able to stay in. Now, you know, I have a friend who's a college professor who says, you know, I can't fail someone because the university needs that person, that butt in that seat. If we fail people, it's bad for us. And we're all adjuncts, so we don't have the kind of security that would give us the ability to reclaim the profession. That model, that for-profit university model, and it's not just the gimmicky ones that you see on you know, 3 o'clock in the morning or that send you the Facebook ads. It's not just them. It's reputable universities now. That is filtering its way down into the K-12 world. And that's bad for democracy. That's bad for a civilization. That's bad for society. Especially when you look at the reality of what's the underlying thing that ties it all together. It's just really about the money. And that's the sickest part. Yeah, it's about the power and the control and the message. And, you know, you can put your Hillsdale College history rewrite in front of your students and you can do all that stuff. But at the end of the day, it's about the greenbacks. It's about the money. That's what Education Incorporated is all about. Getting their greasy little hands into the education coffers. We got to stop it, folks. We've got to stop it. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, this week, as we talked about the other day, the administration moving on the overtime threshold, something, if you remember, during the Obama years, they wanted to set up, I think it was like $47,000 to be exempt from overtime. And you know, Trump whacked that back down to somewhere in the 35 range. Well, the Biden folks have said, no, we're gonna put that back where it should be, somewhere up around $55,000, which I'm all in favor of. We should have done this years ago. This should be, again, another one of those things like minimum wage, tacked to inflation, that goes up as inflation goes up so that it's not eroded away and that you don't work for 100 hours a week for pennies. But here to share some thoughts on this story and, you know, if this is a big deal or not, I've asked Marcus Barham to come talk with us. Marcus is a contributing editor over at Capital & Main, capitalandmain.com, the website, if you want to check out the great work that they do. Marcus, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thank you for having me. Great to be here.
So walk me through what's going on here. What's the point here? Why are we doing this?
Well, we're doing this because for literally over 40 years, tens of millions of American workers who have worked overtime, meaning more than 40 hours a week, which is, you know, time and a half. We all recognize that concept. You know, good pay for good day's work and more pay for when you work extra hours. That has been eroded over time. And so fewer and fewer Americans were earning overtime. Literally tens of millions of Americans were losing out on that money because different ways. I mean, number one, the federal threshold was kept low for a very long time. Until 2004, the threshold at which you automatically are entitled to overtime was about $10,000. So it went from, in 1975, you had 62% of American workers, salaried workers, were eligible for overtime. By 2016, that had dropped to about 7%.
Wow.
So from 62% to 7% over 40 years. It's incredible. So that means that's tens of millions of American workers who lost out in overtime. And so there have been efforts to increase that over the years. Obama tried. They doubled it from what was then the threshold of 23,000 to 47,000, meaning anyone who made less than 47,000 would, if they worked more than 40 hours a week, would qualify for overtime. But that was knocked down by a Texas judge. And then the Trump administration, a few years later, increased it slightly from 23 to about 35,000,
right,
which covered about 15% of American workers, full-time workers. But you know, many people considered it not adequate, of course, because 35,000 is still, you know, far lower than the average salary. And because, are you there?
Yeah.
Sorry, okay. And because it didn't have automatic inflation adjustments every year. What's big about the Biden thing is that, number one, it raises it to 55,000, which is much closer to the average salary. So it'll include at least 3 million more American workers will now be eligible for overtime for working those extra hours. And as we know, many American workers work overtime. And it's going to include automatic increases. That's huge.
No,
that every year, there'll be annual increases to that threshold, which means more and more workers will kind of, you know, it'll lift the boats of all these workers.
No, and that's a great thing. Now, I remember, you know, back during the Obama years when this first came up, and, you know, the Chamber of Commerce and their HIT folks were losing their minds. Oh, we can't afford this. This is going to bankrupt companies. They can't afford it. It's going to raise the cost of products. And I remember saying at the time going, you don't have to pay it. You don't have to pay the $55,000.
Right.
You don't have to pay that salary. You just can't abuse people and work them more than 40 hours and not pay them. That's the simple
right.
solution. If you want to pay them 26 grand a year and then after 40 hours pay them overtime, if you can get people to do the job, that's you can do that. This is simply
right.
saying if you're going to use this, you're going to give someone a special title and make them work 100 hours a week, it better be at a reasonable wage.
Right. Right. Exactly. I mean, there still are questions about the duties test, they call it, which means where they have exemptions for managers. And that's still problematic. But I think the Department of Labor wanted to just focus on the threshold and the automatic increases to get something out the door.
Right.
And I think they learned a lesson from what happened in the Obama years where it was legally challenged successfully. So from what the people I've talked to, including former Obama folks, say that they made this legally defensible. Like they really spent about 2 years preparing this rule and how they would overhaul it to be ready for challenges that would come from the business lobby, which will definitely happen in the next few weeks, next few months. You'll see lawsuits come up.
Oh, I'm sure the other NRA will be front and center there. I'm sure a lot of the NFIB
right.
and all of the usual criminals will be out there doing their foolhardy best to screw workers over, because that's what they do, and they do it well. I mean, to be honest, they've got lobbying arms that are second to none, and they've figured out how to get, you know, low wage workers, especially the other NRA, to actually pay for their lobbying efforts by getting them to take safety courses that they have to pay for.
Right. And this has been a long time coming. I mean, when Marty Walsh first took over as Labor Secretary, when Biden first took over in early 2021, he said that it was too low. The threshold was too low and that he intended to, like, overhaul the overtime rule. And then it didn't happen. They were, like, busy planning it and legally and politically and policy-wise to get it in shape. And then when Walsh left and Julie Hsu was nominated, there's been such a huge confirmation battle over her that they delayed it again. And then I think finally they got to a point where they're kind of like, you know what, even if she's just acting secretary, let's just do it now. And we don't want to wait too much longer, because at the end of the administration, at the end of a term, it's always difficult to get something
yeah.
pushed through. That's what happened to Obama, where he did it too late. And it got, you know, pushed back and the judge knocked it down. And then by that time, the administration didn't have enough time to appeal the ruling. And of course, the Trump people didn't appeal the ruling at all.
Right.
So
no, this is
stuck.
One of those, for me, this last couple of weeks, especially. Where you look at what's coming out of the NLRB, you look at what's coming out of the DOL, you look at all of these
yeah.
things that I've been advocating for the 18 years I've been doing this show. It's they're actually doing this stuff. But I keep saying, look, the reality is, and it's all good stuff. I'm thrilled with all of it. It's good. We need it. We desperately need it. But one election, it could all go away.
Yeah, no, for sure. And that's why I think they're pushing it too. Also, OSHA has come through with some interesting rules and regulations just in the last few weeks. So I think they're doing as much as they can, realizing that they need to get it out there because, you know, once it's done, it can be undone, but it can be difficult. So they're trying to like establish and pass and push through as many of these worker-friendly rules as they can while the clock is ticking.
You know, I go back to this, to your article, and you talk about the difference between the 70s and today. And you, in fact, you say at one point, you know, the, 60% of full-time salaried workers in 75 were getting overtime. You know, we forget that, you know, conditions were much more favorable to workers in the past. And I would argue it's because we had strong unions. Even having strong unions for working people helped management. Because, you know, remember, you know, back, you know, years ago when we would negotiate a new contract, management was saying, hey, get as much as you can, because they knew that whatever we got, they would get a bit of it as well. So we made not just our lives better, but theirs too.
Yeah, that's true. No, for sure. For sure. I think one of the sad things about what's happened with overtime is that because it's been so eroded, most people don't even expect it. So people who in the past, in the 70s and 80s, might have said, oh, yeah, you know what? I should get overtime. What's up with this? And they'd ask their managers. They'd find out more about why they're not getting it. And they'd be upset that because it's become so rare, people are not expecting it. People don't even realize it's there. And so if you don't ask for something, you won't get it for sure. It's had this, you know, this damaging effect.
Yeah, this clearly doesn't affect the gig world. And I know I've got a bunch of gig worker listeners who are, no, we don't want any of these protections. We don't want, you know, minimum wage laws or maximum hour laws. We don't want any of this stuff. We're somehow smarter, better. When the reality is, you know, I look at a lot of these gig worker jobs, it's all about cheating on these fronts, ensuring that you never do get, overtime. You never get even minimum wage in some cases. There's a lot to this, and I think a lot we have to be discussing going forward about what employment in this country looks like.
Right. I mean, the new economy does have a lot of gig workers, and that's going to be a problem for how they get compensated fairly. And there's been many examples, as you've talked about on air, with DoorDash and Uber and other places that where they cheat their workers and not pay them adequately, and there's all kinds of ways with tipping that the workers aren't being compensated. And that'll just continue. The more the economy changes to that kind of working workforce that depends on gig work, depends on temporary jobs. Obviously, down the road is AI, and who knows how that's going to, you know, completely alter the landscape, and also give management an upper hand in terms of, you know, being able to threaten workers and get more for less.
Yeah. No.
So this is a first step, but this will, you know, hopefully this is able to survive the challenges and become sort of a new floor, as it were, for workers and for businesses that have to, you know, comply with the rule.
No, to me, this again is another one of those things that Biden has done that I think is good, something that working people need to know about, understand, internalize, and then want to hold on to. This is the election part of all of this. I hope folks will take a look at your article. The Biden administration seeks to expand overtime pay to millions of U.S. workers, written by Marcus Barham. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at that over at Capital in Maine. But Marcus, as always, great stuff. I look forward to having you back again and talking about what's coming down the pike.
Definitely. Great. Thank you for having me, Rick. And let's talk again soon.
Anytime. Good stuff. Our good friend Marcus Barham. Make sure you check out the work that they do over at Capital in Maine. Going to take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come and talk.
We We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Yeah, I got to tell you, as I've been saying, I think the administration's done some really good work on the employment front. And, you know, I was just thinking during the break, you know, what could they do next? And wage theft seems to be something that I'd like to see some movement on. So, you know, President Biden, if you're up and listening, wage theft. Do something on that. Because what we know is wage theft is a huge, huge problem. Massive. In fact, you know, I love this statistic. I forget the group that put it out. But they said, you know, add up all of the, you know, the bank robberies, the gas station stick-ups, all of the, you know, all the larceny, all of the people stealing from each other's stuff. Add all that up and then multiply it by like 10. And that's what wage theft is in this country. And you go through all of this. Now, understand, you know, what Biden is doing regulatorily with all of these changes is making it easier for people to make a decent living and to get the wages and that they're supposed to. But cutting off all of these ways that employers have been screwing people over. And for me, the other part of this is, you know, this overtime thing has always been just sad. Because I've known people who work in the restaurant industry, for instance, especially fast food, who, you know, they give them like an assistant manager title, and then they pay them like the 20. It was at the time it was like 23.6. You're management. You're one of us. You're on the team, and then end up working them 70, 80 hours a week because, you know, someone didn't show up. You got to cover their shift. You've got to stay because nobody, you know. All of this stuff, you're the backstop for their profits. And it was always amazing to me that people would take that. But I remember someone telling me, and it was weird. And I said, you know, why do you do this? You know, why would you put yourself into it? It's well, because I'm on the management track. You know, eventually I'm gonna be the assistant to the assistant, and then just the assistant. Then I'll be the guy. And you go, but in the meantime, you're getting screwed at every turn. And I said, you know, the reality is you should be compensated for your time. And wage theft is one of those things that you know, the number of people that it's happened to is really incredible. Especially the low wage workforce. And, you know, I was thinking about, you know, I remember the one time, there's been one time in my life I got cheated out of a week's pay. And I was working for a contractor right out of high school. I was swinging a hammer, building really expensive houses. And I got a nail shot through my foot. Just had my foot, you know, on the, I was, you know, leaning over, I was hammering something, and somebody missed the stud and put the nail right into the bottom of my shoe. And it was there I learned about, you know, contract employees. I was not an actual employee, so I had no workers' comp coverage or no health insurance or no way to, to get compensated for the medical bills that came out of the nail in my foot. I had to cover that myself. Rude awakening. But I also didn't get paid for the 3 days that I worked that week. And there was no way to go and fight it. You know, I was just an 18-year-old kid. You know, I didn't know you could go to the state and file a complaint. Now, would they follow up on it? Who knew at the time? But I remember saying this to people, you know, because as somebody who's been fortunate enough to have a union job my whole life, anytime the employer said, yeah, well, we didn't pay you for this, there was a way to get it back. There was a recourse to claw that back through the union, through the grievance procedure. It took me years to realize that not every worker has that ability. And that sometimes they get cheated repeatedly and knowingly get cheated. And everyone knows they're being cheated. But they accept it because at the end of the road, okay, I'm going to get cheated out of a couple of bucks now, but at least I'm not going to lose my job. Because the power we've given these employers. Now, I go back to the Pennsylvania workers' comp law. They still look at it as a master-servant relationship. So when I look at these employment issues, I look at it from the working person's perspective. And like I said, I'm hoping the administration is looking at something around wage theft as well. There's so much out there that could make lives better. Now, again, you know, I come back to the politics of this. And you know, I've had people say, well, you know, why do you have to bring the politics in? You know, I like your union stuff. I like your work stuff. I like your economy stuff. You know, why do you got to talk politics? Because understand, government decides who gets what. These laws were allowed to prop up. These practices were allowed to continue. This stuff was allowed to go on and on and on because nobody said stop. Because the only person that can hold corporate America accountable is a government of, for, and by you and me, we the people. But we've been almost trained to not think that way. And this is where, you know, the Republicans have done a masterful job. They really have. They've done a masterful job in, you know, the government's evil. And they're until recently, to be honest, you know, their faith in corporate America is waning a bit. And I was thinking about this the other night. There's an opportunity for some unity on this front. Because, you know, I've been watching some right-wing commentators going on and on about the abuses of corporate America. Now, understand, you know, it's all because, you know, the woke stuff, you know, corporate America and their diversity. We can't have that. We can't have corporations who care about, you know, equality and diversity. No, no. We just want them greedy. We just want them, you know, pursuing their own radical self-interest without actually understanding what that is. Because diversity and equity could be their radical self-interest. But I digress. There could be a moment where people are fed up with these monopolistic corporations who have robbed us blind on a number of fronts. And this is an opportunity to go, hey, there's an entity that can do that, can hold people accountable. You know, us, through our government. And I say this all the time. It goes back to my eighth grade, you know, civics teacher. Government decides who gets what, which is why we have been getting the short end of the stick for too long. So that's where my mind on this is. And I'm hoping the administration moves in a direction and quickly to go on that, because I don't know where else they go from here. To be honest, I was thinking about my bingo card. If I had a wish list bingo card of, you know, what policies would I like to see them move on? I think I've hit bingo already. So wage theft has got to be up there. They did stuff on heat exposure. Maybe hire more OSHA inspectors so it doesn't take 200 years to inspect every site. Maybe that's something we can do. Yeah, I'm excited about the possibilities. The fact that they're reshoring manufacturing and we're seeing apprenticeships growing, that we're seeing job programs growing, we're seeing opportunities grow. This is why when I get people who email me say, well, you beat up on Joe Biden, I don't think so. I think I have been more effusive with praise for him than any politician ever in my lifetime. Because this is the stuff that I've been talking about for years on how we rebuild that prosperous working class. It's that simple. I would like to see better Capitol borders, maybe. I mean, if we're talking way down wish list. I would like to see our trade policies, you know, revamped to where, again, we put more into domestic production for domestic consumption. I think that is a smart way to go. But to this point, I'm thrilled with the guy. Now, here's the thing. Got to get him reelected. Because all of these policies, while I think they're fabulous, they can be undone. And this is where the politics of understanding who sits in that Oval Office and who they appoint. Because remember, the former guy talked about the very best people. He's going to put the very best people in. And what did those very best people do? They used every regulatory lever to hurt working people, to the advantage of corporate interest, to the moneyed interest. And look, their belief structure is, if it's good for corporate America, it'll eventually trickle down. It'll be good for you at some point down the road. And I think we viscerally know that's not reality. That's not how that game plays. So, like I said, I'm thrilled. I'm looking forward to the next week to see what comes, what the next policy is. But so far, great stuff. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, our good friend Bob Ney is going to be here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day. Right back after this.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, evidently, Marjorie Three Names is putting down her demands. The only way she's going to vote to not shut the government down is if she gets her impeachment inquiry. Not an impeachment. No, no. Just the inquiry. You know, we need the inquiry because they've got nothing. But they need it because it's the red meat that's going to keep everybody all bunched up in the panties. But this is the only way, according to her, that she sees us funding our government. When can we get rid of crackpots like this? Please, Georgia, please, I'm begging you. There's got to be someone sane and rational within your county borders or within your district to get rid of this. It's just got to be. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on this and the other top stories of the day, our good friend, former Ohio Congressman and political analyst Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
So what do you think of this? The pound of flesh is, I'll vote to not destroy our economy. I'll vote to not shut the government down and cause pain and misery for thousands of federal workers. But my pound of flesh is I got to have my impeachment inquiry.
The thing that shocked or disappointed me is the White House responding. You know what they need to say? I'm cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs.
Yeah.
Seriously. Just say, I'm cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, okay? But, they're saying that the last thing American people deserve is for extreme House members to trigger government shutdown. It just gives her, this is what she wants. She wants recognized. Let them deal with her. Look, there's members of the Republican caucus that do not want an impeachment inquiry. Let them fight her. Let her fight them. It's a circular firing squad. Let them go at it.
Yeah. No, I'm all in favor of it. No, please, by all means. Go ahead. Do your impeachment thing. Go ahead. Because, you've got nothing. Every time James Comer says, hey, we've got a witness, we've got a secret whistleblower, they can't find him. They build up, we've got all this information, and then, well, not really. We've got some allegations that we think might possibly be true, that somebody made up or thought dreamt up. I mean, by all means, go ahead. If that's the best you can do to make the lives of us better, knock yourself out. Go do your impeachment inquiry.
Marjorie Taylor Greene does this, you know, to appeal to certain people in her district. Like I said, if I was the White House, I would ignore her. I really, on this case, you know, if the speaker says it, you know, that's different. But don't give her attention like she's, you know, running the place.
I'm with you. I got to get your thoughts on some of the sentencing today. You got to be a little bit happier with some of the sentences coming out. You got the Joe Biggs guy yesterday, 17 years. You got this other guy, Ethan Nordine, 18 years. Another guy got 10 years. This Spazzolini, I guess, is his nickname. Now we're getting down to somebody doing some real time.
Right, because you and I talked about this. The first sentence out of the box was like, okay, you can't you do better than that? You know, it needed to get tougher because a tough sentence means more plea deals is what that means, which saves trial time. And then you do the plea deal and people do some time over this. Some said, well, it's not enough, and some said it's too much. So, yeah, judge went in the middle, but it's a long enough sentence, and it's federal time. You have to do 85% of federal time. There's no parole board, as in the state most state governments. So 85% of the time, they're going to do it.
Well, you know, and good for them. You know, at the end of the day, you now they'll get to see just how wonderful the prison system is. Because I guarantee, and this is what I've been saying all through this, especially the people who are complaining about the D.C. jail, which I do understand is a horrible place. But the whining that's going on, I guarantee these are the folks who are saying, you know, jail's just too easy on people. They shouldn't have, you know, swimming pools and color TVs. Because I don't know about you, but I know lots of people who believe jail is like Club Med.
Well, believe me, you're talking to somebody that hears, but I still hear it. Oh, you went to Club Fed, you know, because they did that documentary years ago. And, you know, do they have a ping pong table there? Yeah. Do they have, you know, one treadmill or two? Yes, they do. You know, there's an email system that you can't get on the internet, but you can send, they read it, send it. You're limited to 10 people for communication purposes. When they say libraries, they've got some books and it's small, but it's no Club Fed, and it is warehousing. You know, you got a test, you need a proctor and accounts for your school program. And I knew one guy that was going to a high university, and the guards wouldn't proctor for him, and so he lost his entire quarter. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not Club Fed. That's Club Punishment.
No, and this is where maybe they're going to come out, and maybe they're going to – it's going to be interesting to see how some of these people come out, and especially the ones who got real sentences, the ones who got 6 months. It's a badge of honor for them. But the people who come out with real sentences, it'll be interesting to see what they come out and what they do after this.
Well, here's what will happen to them, too, because, look, I was incarcerated with 1,300 people. And what ends up happening, now we didn't have any, you know, Proud Boys, but we had people, you know, pretty significant, you know, in some crimes they committed and things. And we had some, you know, wealthy people, et cetera. You had all types of people. But what will happen with the Proud Boys is they'll go in there and they'll be like, you know, wow, it's the Proud Boys. Wow, we stormed the Capitol. And that'll get them some notoriety and make them feel like, wow, you know, they're really kind of on top of the system for about 3 to 4 months. And that will end. And then they will be, like, not only bored out of their minds, but ready to pull their hair out. So, yeah, that notoriety will last a little while. And by the way, if they get any notions of talking to the press, good luck on that, too.
Jail's one of those places I've never wanted to be, and I'm glad I haven't. Mm-hmm. But, you know, sometimes it's interesting to see where they're going to play out. Speaking of jail, I'm watching Rudy Giuliani. I was thinking about this today. The Trump fall from the high perch has been, you know, pretty bad. But Giuliani, I mean, this has got to be the biggest fall from grace. And probably, like, I would argue probably in the history of this country. He was America's mayor. I mean, he was at after 9/11, he was the guy. He was the guy who slayed the mob. He was the guy who was the mayor of New York during 9/11. And and to see what he has become. Wow. And this story today, and I got to get your thoughts on this, because I know you're not a big fan of Giuliani, especially with his dealings with the Mujahideen cult. But they're now saying, a whistleblower from the FBI is now saying that he was compromised by Russian intelligence. Because he was traipsing around Ukraine looking for any dirt possible on Joe Biden. And they're saying, you know, well, you know, and the guy actually, his name is out there. There's no secret whistleblower. This is a whistleblower that someone actually found. Any thoughts on this?
Right. This story, I think, is really appalling. You know, the FBI agent says that Giuliani was co-opted by Russian intelligence. Whether co-opted without him knowing it or co-opted with him knowing it, either way, they're saying he was co-opted. And then, of course, the FBI itself is declining to, you know, say anything at this point in time. But at one time, I mean, I really, really liked Giuliani. I really did. I mean, I think he really took some good steps in New York. He was the nation's mayor. He handled 911. You know, he was just something else. And after he left, you know, I was one of those like, hey, Giuliani could be, you know, run for president. I was in that category. And then the first strike, as you mentioned, the Mujahideen Kalk, which was on the terror list, which was also supported by John Bolton, but Rudy did it for money. And at that point in time, I started to say, wow, he signed up with a terrorist group. It was at that time, it's not designated anymore, to make it clear, but it was. And they took our hostages. They were responsible. And he signed up with them. I think he took 125, 150,000, I forget. And when he did that, of a group that's an official terrorist group, I thought, money is going to be the ruination of this guy.
Yeah.
And then it just got worse from there. You know, he did things for money. And then I think he wanted to be important, you know, so he would advise Trump, including being intoxicated advising Trump, which he might have advised him maybe with better advice when he's intoxicated, you think? I don't know.
No, look, I mean, you know, the sad reality is alcohol ruins a lot of lives.
Yes.
I look at Rudy going, you know, maybe lay off the sauce.
But he's not stopping. I'm in recovery myself. You know, I make no bones about it. But he didn't stop. He's still at it. And then all the other things in the movie where he was laying on the bed, and I'm like, wow. I mean, he could have been a think tank guy. He could have went around the country and gave speeches, you know, on whatever issues he wanted, including, you know, beating up the government here and there. But instead, he's getting disbarred. He's in criminal trials, you know, everything under the sun. It's really sad. It is a sad ending. It really is.
No, it is. And I come back to, it was Trump that did it to him. I mean, Trump finally put the nail in the coffin. I mean, he was headed down that path. But, you know, he's now going broke. He doesn't have money to pay his lawyers, evidently. He's selling his apartment. He's, you know, all this horrible stuff is happening to him because of he bought into this stuff. And I got to wonder, you know, because I saw this story that this, you know, an FBI agent, you know, says he's been turned by the Russians. And immediately my mind goes, you know, because the Trump world has done a great job of inoculating us against anything that Russia does. So, you know, immediately when I saw this, my mind goes, well, you know, they're going to say it's a hoax. You know, it's a witch hunt. You know, it's all that stuff. But this guy, this Jonathan Bouma, actually put his name on it, which was shocking to me.
Well, and also Giuliani had a relationship with Pavel Fuchs, who was, you know, he's a wealthy Ukrainian developer. And then he hired Giuliani. Now, there were two different versions of why he hired him, Giuliani's version and then his version. And then he changed his version, Fuchs did, back to Giuliani's version. But here's the bottom line. They're making the statement that the FBI assessed Fuchs, who paid Giuliani, that Fuchs was a co-opted asset of Russian intelligence services. So they used him to advance their goals. And, you know, Giuliani was wrapped up in that. And, you know, I mean, I know very well, you get wrapped up with people, and if they smell, you smell. And that's what happens. And the odor coming from Giuliani now is unbelievable. I mean, again, what a way to end what used to be a well-respected career.
No, I mean, it's amazing to me. I mean,
And you know, Rick, it's not one of the Americans love second chances. They do. It's a great country for, you know, having grace and stuff. But with Rudy Giuliani, he's never going to repair this damage.
No, he can't recover from this.
He can't. It's done.
No, and there's a point at which you go, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to. He needs to be locked up. I mean, that's where my mind goes. With all of the stuff that's going on, for instance, you know, he didn't even put up a defense in the defamation suit that was brought against him. And I guess, you know, legal experts have said he didn't want to go through discovery because there's probably a lot of bad stuff in there that will most certainly be used against him.
And he's out on his own, and Trump didn't pay him, and he's not part of the system anymore. And I'm not sure, because he's so far down and so far in trouble, I'm not sure that people will come to his defense.
Yeah.
You know, when you get in trouble, if you've got some past relationships, you've got some friendships, et cetera, and if you're not too hot of a hot potato, people will step in to give you some help. But when you've reached Giuliani status, I don't think a lot of the wealthy cats are going to be opening the checkbook up to help him.
No, I don't think so either. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman, political analyst. I got to get your thoughts on Mitch McConnell. I don't wish anybody ill. I hope he's okay. I hope he retires and goes off, does his thing. I've got some people emailing me, saying, hope bad things for him. I don't wish anybody bad because I believe in karma. But I do find it interesting that Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear has said that or has declined to say that he would appoint a Republican if that seat becomes vacant. I got to tell you, my thought on this is there is no way in a cold day that I would replace that seat with a Republican if I were the Democrat, only because Mitch McConnell, in the spirit of Mitch McConnell, Mitch McConnell would have never appointed a Democrat to replace a Democrat. He'd have stolen the seat. What do you think?
I mean, they can appoint whoever they want, correct?
Yes.
Doesn't have to be Republican.
No.
Okay. So, so what you're saying is, what would a Democrat governor do?
The Democratic governor declined to say whether he was going to follow the state law. Now, evidently, there is a state law in Kentucky that they have to replace somebody with the same party.
Oh, they do.
But he said he's declined to say whether he's going to follow that law. Well, I'm of the mindset that Mitch McConnell would not have followed that law.
Well, I think if there is a law, that's why I was wondering. If there's a law, he's a Democrat governor, and there's a law, he probably will follow to appoint a Republican.
And that's why Democrats lose.
You know? If there's a law.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is one of those things that this is why the Republicans win, because I don't think they would. Finally, got to get your thought on Matt Schlapp.
Do I think Mitch would?
Yes.
I'm sorry, no, he wouldn't. No.
See?
Remember what he did with judges?
Yes.
Well, let's wait till the election. Oh, wait a minute, now we got our guy, we won't wait till the next election? Of course he. Oh, no.
Heads I win, tails you lose. Finally, got to get your thoughts on the CPAC guy, this Matt Schlapp. Evidently, Matt and his wife, Mercedes, it's time for a new beginning, I guess. And they held an exorcism. They held an exorcism in the CPAC offices.
Are you making this up?
I am not making this up.
I haven't heard that. Matt Schlapp held an exorcism?
As part of a reset, the Schlapps turned to a priest to evict satanic spirits from their D.C. offices. Because look, Schlapp's got all these young guys that he's been fondling and groping and pursuing.
Oh, the story is on Walker's campaign. The story is hideous. It's not just, it's hideous. I've read it twice.
Yeah. I mean, so there's all this stuff. So of course, I guess if you're in that world, it's the demons made me do it. The devil made me do it. So this seems almost logical if you try and put yourself in that kind of that mindset that the devil made me do it. So we've got to exorcise the demons. Well, so why not do an exorcism?
Well, let me say this. As far as a 12-year Catholic school, grad, do I believe in the Church's dogma on the ability to teach exorcisms to priests? Yes, I do. Is it possible a case that someone could have a type of demon possession? Possibly they could. Should CPAC, should CPAC have a exorcism? Absolutely not. Exorcism for what? Because the employees resigned. They were protesting what happened last year with MatchLab and the whole scandal. That's why they resigned. They didn't resign because they were demon possessed. This is unreal. Why would you do that?
Because you're you know, this is one of those weird things. You know, I had a guy, Jeff Charlotte, on the show a number of years back. He wrote a book about C Street, about the religious folks who they believe that they're entitled, that they're chosen. So no matter what they do wrong, it's forgiven because they're the chosen. You know, Mark Sanford, the guy from South Carolina who was down on the Appalachian Trail. He was one of those people. That's how he got to be a congressman again. This fits that mold in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Well, I mean, you know, if one of the employees' heads was turning backwards and things and they were spitting across the room, I would say bring the priest in. But if they're resigning because they're, like, really kind of angry at Matt Schlapp, I'm not sure that the priest is the right. Maybe, I don't know, bring maybe the lawyers in. I don't know.
We're going to exorcise the demons and no more harassing young men.
You can't make this stuff up.
No.
You can't.
No. And if you did, no one would believe you.
No one would. No. They would turn us away and put us away.
There you go. Bob, I hope you have a good holiday. Happy Labor Day.
You too. Happy Labor Day.
Look forward to talking to
all the workers
again
out there.
Thanks so much. Our good friend Bob Ney. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Yeah, maybe during the break we'll do a little exorcism here in the studio. Oh man. Right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1859. That was the day the first Pullman sleeping car made an overnight trip. The first Pullman sleeper was a renovated day coach. That first trip was made on the Chicago and Alton Railroad between Bloomington, Illinois and Chicago. Pullman continued to improve his sleeping cars to make long-distance train travel more comfortable and luxurious. Inspired by company towns in Essen, Germany and Saltire, England, Pullman bought land south of Chicago to build his company town. He named his new town Pullman and moved all of his manufacturing operations there. There were other sleeping cars at that time, but George Pullman refined the sleeping car and built a monopoly. As for his company town, initially it seemed to be a great success. Visitors to Chicago flocked to Pullman to view the model town. But then there was a severe economic depression in 1893. This caused Pullman to lower the wages of his employees. However, Pullman did not also lower the rents he charged to live in the company town. Prices of goods for sale in the town were not lowered either. Disgruntled workers went on strike. Many of the strikers joined the American Railway Union, started by Eugene V. Debs. This union organized a boycott, and railroad workers across the country refused to service any train with a Pullman car. The U.S. Attorney General issued an injunction demanding that the strikers cease in their activities or face being fired. Eventually, President Cleveland sent in federal troops to end the boycott. As a result, 30 workers were killed across the nation. Pullman died a few years later, and today, his Pullman Palace car that transformed the transportation industry is a relic of history. But his legacy of slashing wages lives on. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Back to the Rick Smith Show. Real quick, I'm going to wrap up with a couple of emails. Lewis sent me an email agreeing with me on the higher education front, and I like when I get these emails. He said, Rick, you've never spoken more true words about the education situation in our country right now. He says, I was an academic for over 26 years at the university level, and it is all about money. He says, I've taught in elite private universities and at state schools. What both have in common, making that money. At the state school I used to teach at, the university instituted a policy where, now get this, if a student got a C, they could take the class over. In my day, and probably yours, the only way you could take a class over is if you got an F or anything else. That was not a do-over. Now green rules, very sad indeed. And look, I've had this conversation with numerous professors who tell me the same thing. You know, and they get pressure from above if they give bad grades, because they want those, they want people going through. And TB in Santa Fe sends me some thoughts on, look, I understand Biden has had problems. I understand he's got a speech impediment. I understand he's had stuff. I'm just pointing out the reality of Biden's getting up there in age. He doesn't speak as well as Obama did or as Clinton did. But for me, that's not important. What's important is what he is doing. That's what's important. But she points out the important part in all of this. And the part that maybe I haven't made clear enough. Yeah, the Republicans are beating him up because he's not a good speaker. And I'm not beating him up. I'm just simply agreeing. Yeah, he's not a great speaker. It is what it is. And I think he would probably tell you, he's not a great speaker. He's got some issues. He's a good policy guy. I'm spot on the policy. Spot on making people's lives better. And when the debates come and when the election comes, as answering that question, are you better off than you were 4 years ago when everything was locked down under the former guy? You're going to have to answer yes. But she does ask the question, what are Republicans doing? And the answer is nada. She's absolutely right. They're whining about Joe being not a good speaker. And she is right. So I'm with you, TB. I'm 100% there. Simply saying, admit the deficiencies and then move forward on the strengths. You know, I've had numbers of people, he can't give a sentence. Okay, fine. I'm okay with that. You know, he falls asleep. Yeah, because he's an old guy, needs a nap. I'm okay with him taking a nap. I'm a lot younger. I take naps. I'm pro nap. So, like I said, admit what he does. I 100%. But the policies he's moving, man, I'm there. And that's what we should be fighting for. The things that he's done that are going to make our lives better. Those things that are in place that we want to hold on to. Those things that finally we're going to get that are going to give us opportunities that we've got to grab with both fists and white knuckle ride into prosperity. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks, guys. Miss any portion of the program, email, obviously, podcast. Make sure you grab the podcast wherever you get yours, ours. Have a happy Labor Day. We'll see you back next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.